Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. I'm your host, Chase Dalton. The Vietnam War absolutely devastated the United States Navy. Both Presidents Johnson and Nixon slashed the budgets for naval construction, research and development, modernization, and long-term maintenance to pay for the short-term needs of intense combat operations in support of the Vietnam War. By the end of the Vietnam era, the Navy ships were old, in poor repair, and for the first time since World War II, facing down a peer competitor in the Soviet fleet, which had just undergone massive expansion. Under Admiral Gorshkov, who led the Soviet Navy from 1956 to 1985, the Soviet Navy was transformed from one that could not challenge the U.S. cordon around Cuba and had to back down during the Cuban Missile Crisis into a serious rival. Gorshkov's transformed force boasted modern submarines and surface ships equipped with very advanced missile systems, which could, and did, regionally challenge the U.S. Navy's supremacy at sea. During the 1967 Arab-Israeli War and the 1970 Jordanian Civil War, the U.S. Navy just could not support the war in Vietnam and simultaneous confrontation with a locally concentrated Soviet naval power, and this helped influence the U.S. Navy's backdown from these military interventions. The standoff during the October 1973 Yom Kippur War, where the Soviet Union began a massive resupply effort supporting their Syrian and Egyptian allies, while the U.S. did the same for our Israeli allies, revealed the weakened post-Vietnam capacity of the U.S. Navy. Following the joint Syrian-Egyptian invasion of Israel on October 5, 1973, the U.S. Navy increased our presence from 43 to 65 warships, while the USSR surged from 55 to 98. The Israeli army overcame really overwhelming odds and crushed the invading Arab armies, and advanced on the capitals of both Egypt and Syria. But the superiority of the Soviet fleet in the theater, combined with the unfolding Watergate crisis at home, hobbled the United States' ability to support Israel further in the war and force Israel to moderate its war aims. But the growth of the Soviet Navy was just hitting its stride. By the end of the 1970s, the Soviet fleet massively outnumbered the U.S. Navy in every class except for aircraft carriers, which they made up for in superior anti-ship missile technology and range. Against the rising tide of the Soviet Navy, naval planners and strategists had to abandon the Mahanian concept of a decisive battle to establish command at sea for a more narrowly focused mission of sea denial, where we hoped to prevent the Soviets from using the sea to their advantage while keeping the sea lines of communication open during the always looming hypothetical Soviet invasion of Central and Western Europe. But even this may have been too much, with Admiral Zumwalt, who had previously been in charge of all maritime forces in Vietnam, and since promoted to the Chief of Naval Operations in 1970, and now the highest-ranking officer in the United States Navy at the astonishingly young age of 49, said, quote, "The odds are that we would be unable to protect both the Atlantic sea lines of communication and NATO's flank against the Soviet Navy." The Soviet naval building boom between 1966 and 1970, when the U.S. was totally unable to match it due to the resource drain of the Vietnam War, the Soviets commissioned 209 ships to the U.S. Navy's 88. The World War II-era ships, which had sustained the U.S. fleet since the end of the last World War, were at the end of their useful life and were not being replaced. By contrast, the entire Soviet fleet was practically new, built for modern weapon systems with none of the resource-draining, end-of-life maintenance issues which plagued the U.S. Navy. By 1978, the Soviet fleet boasted 740 major warships to the U.S. Navy's 289. Starting in the 1970s, the Navy under Zumwalt began to slowly shed the legacy of Vietnam and modernize. Vietnamization meant the withdrawal of ships from the theater and allowed some of the more obsolete World War II-era relics to be decommissioned to free up money for new construction and modernization. A high-low mix acquisition strategy, in which a small number of cutting-edge ships and aircraft, the high, paired with a large number of less expensive and capable units, the low, theoretically allowed for a much larger force while maintaining some units to fight the best the Soviets had to offer. As Zumwalt, who architected the controversial strategy, wrote in his memoirs, quote, "An all-high navy would be so expensive that we would not have enough ships to control the sea. An all-low navy would not have the capability to meet certain kinds of threats or perform certain kinds of missions. In order to have both enough ships and good enough ships, there had to be a mix of high and low." end quote. The lower-end units would be more than enough to satisfy the Navy's global requirements in secondary theaters against enemies with less advanced weapon systems. The high-low mix was a matter of debate then, and that debate has resurfaced today around the Littoral Combat Ship class and the under-construction Constellation frigate. Among the investment in new high-end systems, this strategy produced 31 Spruance-class destroyers equipped with anti-submarine helicopters for detecting and sinking Soviet submarines in the event of war, 27 Ticonderoga-class guided missile cruisers, which boasted new Harpoon and Tomahawk cruise missiles, and the Spy-1 phased array radar and its associated revolutionary Aegis combat system, which is a command and control and weapons control platform capable of tracking and shooting down hundreds of air targets across thousands of square miles by providing mid-flight tracking and guidance to our missiles. The development was led for 13 years by Rear Admiral Wayne E. Father of Aegis Meyer, and was an engineering stinking miracle at the time, giving the U.S. Navy a huge advantage over the more limited Soviet combat systems. The Aegis system, in heavily modified and upgraded form, of course, is still the core of the Navy's anti-air and missile guidance systems today. On the aviation front, the F-14 Tomcat replaced the F-4 Phantom II as the fleet's premier air superiority fighter, fleet defense interceptor, and tactical aerial reconnaissance platform, which paired with a versatile F-A-18 fighter bomber, rounded out a significantly upgraded carrier air wing. Nonetheless, these upgrades would take time to build and percolate, and the Soviets had not stopped building. Admiral Rickover, who oversaw the development of the U.S. Navy's submarine fleet, testified before Congress that he would prefer to command the Soviet submarine fleet into battle should war break out, and the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Zumwalt, agreed with him that the U.S. Navy would probably lose a shooting war at sea if it came down to it. But the challenges to the Navy did not come just from the Soviet Union alone. The simmering racial and societal tensions in broader American society during the tumultuous years were echoed in the Navy. When Zumwalt took over as the Chief of Naval Operations in 1970, the Navy had fallen badly behind the cultural times, and with the end of conscription in 1973, recruiting and retention were, to say the least, very poor. Throughout his 4 years as CNO, Zumwalt issued 121 Z-grams, which were direct messages sent out fleet-wide aimed at reforming the strict regulations of the Navy. When I look today at the list of Z-grams and orders that Zumwalt reformed, it's pretty eye-opening that only 50 years ago, the service treated sailors, and in particular the enlisted corps, so poorly. Enlisted sailors below the rank of chief petty officer were not allowed to have civilian clothes on the ship, transit to or from work in civilian clothes, or wear civilian clothes on liberty, which is Navy lingo for time off of work. And all of that changed as part of the pilot program of Z-Gram 5. Z-Gram 15 ordered that sailors be given an actual breakdown of their pay, which apparently had been a mystery prior to this, as various special pays were added and taxes and fees were taken out. Z-Gram 21 instructed commanding officers to provide time off to compensate if a sailor was on duty during a holiday, and Z-Gram 38 directed officers to avoid regularly scheduling evolutions on a Sunday to allow the crew at least one day of rest a week, while Z-Gram 43 directed that travel reimbursement be paid in a reasonable time frame instead of being a lingering financial time bomb on the head of poorly paid sailors. Z-Gram 57, or, quote, demeaning or abrasive regulations, elimination of, caused a huge uproar in the naval establishment when it was issued on November 10, 1970. The first paragraph reads, quote, 1. Those demeaning or abrasive regulations, generally referred to in the fleet as, quote, Mickey Mouse, end quote, or, quote, chicken regs, have, in my judgment, done almost as much to cause dissatisfaction among our personnel as have extended family separation and low pay scales. For this reason, shortly after taking command, I requested a comprehensive review of current naval policies and regulations. I desire to eliminate many of the most abrasive policies, standardize others which are inconsistently enforced, and provide some general guidance which reflects my conviction that if we are to place the importance and responsibility of, quote, the person in proper perspective in the most efficient Navy we are seeking, the worth and personal dignity of the individual must be forcefully reaffirmed. The policy changes below are effective immediately and will be amplified by more detailed implementing directives to be issued separately. I wish time allowed me to read you all of this, as it caused quite a turmoil within the Navy, but I'll put a link in the show notes if you're interested. In short, it alarmed traditionalists who worried that it would breed a soft, permissive attitude among the sailors in the fleet, with reforms such as allowing sailors to grow neat beards and mustaches, allowing sailors to wear working uniforms instead of only dress uniforms to and from work, around the base, and at the evening meal aboard ships. Allow sailors to take leave and overnight liberty without extensive paperwork, allow motorcycles to be driven on base, prohibited commands from forcing sailors to conduct refueling, line work, and topside watches in inclement weather while wearing ceremonial uniforms, which must have been a thing, but it's hard to imagine today, among the many, many other changes. The change which I think is funny, and almost certainly still happens regularly though, is outlined in paragraph G, which says, quote, "When visiting fleet units, I not only do not wish to see fresh paint applied strictly because of my visit, but consider that rusted surfaces hastily painted over are a reflection of poor command discretion. This type of preparation for any senior officer visit shall be prohibited." Although I can tell you from personal experience, when I was in active duty, the Secretary of the Navy was scheduled to visit my ship as part of a waterfront tour, and the entire ship got a fresh coat of paint. And, you know, he comes aboard and takes a big sniff. Ah, smells like the Secretary of the Navy is here for a visit, meaning the fresh paint that gets applied to every ship before such an important officer comes to visit. But ZGRAM 66, it recognized that the problems that minority sailors had in the Navy were very significant and directed steps to change that. It's another great ZGRAM, and I'll include the link in the show notes, and I highly recommend reading it. It's extremely well written, and I feel that any leader could benefit from it. ZGRAM 66 closes with, quote, "Seek out and eliminate those demeaning areas of discrimination that plague our minority shipmates. Ours must be a Navy family that recognizes no artificial barriers of race, color, or religion. There is no black Navy, no white Navy, just one Navy, the United States Navy." One of Zumwalt's last ZGRAMs, Z116, was issued in August of 1972 and significantly expanded the roles that women could serve in. This set in motion the Naval Academy class in 1980, which was the first to admit women, and the gradual expansion of the roles women can serve in today. Today, there are only a few small and specialized roles, such as Navy SEAL teams, in which women cannot serve. And I think it's more likely than not that we'll see all roles open up to women in the medium term. The social upheaval of the 1970s hit the Navy hard. And in October of 1972, after a grueling 8 months on station off the coast of Vietnam, racial tensions spilled over into race riots aboard the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk. Days later, a similar incident occurred on board an oiler, and in November, a third riot forced the carrier Constellation to abort training exercises and return to San Diego. A lot of senior officers and enlisted leadership in the Navy blamed Zumwalt's new policies for the breakdown in discipline. But to Zumwalt's immense credit, he took the opposite tact and saw the underlying issue of unfair racial treatment leading to the breakdown of discipline as a need to reinforce the equal treatment for minority sailors. By 1974, Nixon was gone and Ford was defeated in the 1976 race for the presidency by a member of the Naval Academy class of 1946, President Jimmy Carter, a former nuclear submarine officer who pursued what was essentially a policy of unilateral naval disarmament based on his belief that if the United States was the first to reduce its military budgets, that the Soviet Union would follow suit and break the never-ending arms race. Carter spiked the construction of a fourth Nimitz-class carrier in 1977 and cut the Ford administration shipbuilding plan in half. Predictably, the Soviet Union did not see this as a great opportunity to sit around the metaphorical campfire and bask in the glow of global good relations and poverty reduction, as Jimmy Carter envisioned, but instead saw it as an opportunity to build even more ships and wrest global maritime supremacy from the creaking United States Navy. By 1978, the Navy's numerical advantage in every class of ship other than carriers had worsened. In every other class of major warship, the Soviet surface fleet outnumbered the United States Navy's 443 to 196. The Soviets held a 294 to 119 submarine advantage, and the forecast did not look likely to improve under Carter's presidency. The United States was forced to replace a global naval strategy with a regional one, where the Navy's primary role would be the defense of the Atlantic sea lines of communication. In the event of World War III, the Pacific Fleet would abandon the Pacific Ocean to the Soviets and sprint to the Atlantic to defend a protected sea lane against the Soviet Army as the U.S. Army and supplies raced towards Europe. The legacy of Vietnam and the failure to spend enough money on the Navy in the following 15 years was on stark display in the Middle East. The shambolic post-World War II British economy and the loss of her colonies and protectorates caused Britain to withdraw her navy from the region in 1968, and to defend the oil in the region that the Western world relied on, the United States Navy deployed to fill in the gap. Iran was the traditional local U.S. and British ally in the region, with Saudi Arabia as the junior partner. The Iranian state was the descendant of Persia, one of the oldest civilizations in human history, and functioned competently compared to the still nascent Arab states. Plus, the Shah, the ruler of Iran, was pro-Western, and so we partnered with Iran to maintain regional stability. Carter, however, was a champion of humanitarian and liberal reforms and pushed the Shah to further liberalize his country, which backfired spectacularly as the conservative majority of the population backed the 1979 takeover of the country by fundamentalist Islamic revolutionaries led by Ayatollah Khomeini. Whether he would have wanted to intervene or not, Carter simply did not have the military forces at his disposal to deploy to Iran to prop up the failing regime. The Ayatollah's followers had a decisively anti-U.S. point of view, given the U.S.'s backing of the Shah, and took 66 U.S. hostages at the U.S. embassy during the opening days of the Iranian Revolution, and demanded that they be exchanged for the Shah, who was in the U.S. for cancer treatment at the time. Carter was obviously not going to turn over the Shah, but he did finally authorize a fourth Nimitz-class carrier 4 days later. Less than 3 months after the embassy takeover, the Soviets reluctantly invaded Afghanistan to prop up their puppet ruler in the country against its own fundamentalist uprising. This scared the West. Would the Soviets push into the Persian Gulf next? The Soviets were already huge net oil exporters, and if they gained control of the Gulf, they would be able to absolutely devastate Western economies by simply cutting off oil exports at a time of geopolitical tension or war. No other allied country had the strength or the will to take on the role Britain abandoned in the Middle East. It had to be the United States. In 1980, Carter took a hard line against the rising tide of Soviet power in the Middle East and issued the Carter Doctrine, stating that any attempt by an outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region would be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States, and that such an assault would be repelled by any means necessary, including military force. Carter deployed a joint task force, which is the structure that the military uses to coordinate a specific set of operations between all of the branches, the Army, the Navy, and the Marines, and the Air Force, in the region behind its work, and by the spring of 1980, there were 30 U.S. warships deployed to the region. In April of 1980, Operation Eagle Claw was launched to rescue the 66 American hostages still being held at the embassy. Eagle Claw ended in a disaster when a helicopter collided with a transport plane in the Iranian desert. The embarrassment of the operation, combined with a weak economy at home, contributed to Carter's defeat in the 1980 presidential election and the emergence of the Reagan era. The 66 hostages were released the day Reagan took office as a final Iranian insult to Carter. The Reagan era marked a philosophical shift in American thinking towards the Soviet Union. Reagan would use the strength of the American economy, which even amid high unemployment at the time was roughly twice as large as the Soviet Union's, to build a military to defeat the Soviets. In his mind, there was no reason why our military should be unable to respond to a Soviet provocation anywhere in the world. Reagan called for the implementation of the Maritime Strategy. The Maritime Strategy was not a single document, but it evolved over time across many CNOs, but was popularized and formalized by Reagan's Secretary of the Navy, John Layman, who convinced the Reagan administration that we needed a 600-ship Navy. The Maritime Strategy was formalized in the 80s, but had its origins in the 70s in response to the growth of the Soviet Navy and the threat of a newly assertive Soviet Navy cruising and asserting its own power in areas that the United States Navy had previously had to itself. The Maritime Strategy essentially answered the emerging question of how the United States Navy would confront and deal with the Soviet Navy, and beyond that, how the United States Navy was relevant to a potential war scenario that would take place in Central Europe. In the Vietnam era, the Navy had been focused on power projection inland, with carrier strike aircraft and riverine craft aimed at a guerrilla force. Soon what began to change that focus towards war at sea. The 600 ship number came from an analysis of 400, 600, and 800 ship variants. It was based on a blueprint for victory at sea versus the Soviets. The Navy would act on the flanks of the USSR, in Norway, the Mediterranean, the Pacific, mimicking the British and French strategy during the Crimean War of distracting disproportionate forces away from the main front in Central Europe. The Soviets would want to fight only in Europe, but the Navy would not allow that. The U.S. Navy would also threaten the USSR's nuclear submarine bastions, and thus hopefully impact their decision-making about taking the war nuclear. The main worry that the USSR had was our carrier aircraft attack on their flanks, because at the time, carriers were equipped with tactical nuclear weapons, and Tomahawk tactical nukes launched from submarines and surface ships later in the Cold War, which presented a nuclear threat to the fight on their flanks. This strategy also necessitated the need to defend ships attacking the Soviet flanks from mass land-based aircraft attacks, which led to the Spy Aegis systems so that we could shoot their aircraft and missiles down. And here is retired Rear Admiral Michael McDevitt talking about and remembering some details of the maritime strategy and how even then the margins that we were fighting on would not perhaps as comfortable as we would have liked.
So there's stories or articles and interviews that suggest that particularly when the Russians had a chance to see naval operations up close, visiting aircraft carriers and seeing that, were suitably impressed by it all. That may be so, but I guess I have lingering in the back of my mind is that the Soviets, by the same token, were busy building capabilities that were awfully intimidating. New submarines that were very quiet, very fast, some that were specifically designed to carry an awful lot of anti-ship cruise missiles who were not hiding out back protecting things. They were going to be out in the Atlantic and the Pacific to intercept carriers and take them on. Backfire bombers that kept multiplying in terms of numbers and the capabilities of the missiles they were carrying. So I, for one, am very happy that we never had to try to execute the maritime strategy, because I've always thought, particularly in hindsight, thinking about it, it may have been a 50-50 shot whether we were successful in our ambitions as opposed to having a bloody disaster on our hands.
The maritime strategy and the 600-ship Navy concept centered around 15 carrier battle groups with new planes to fly off of them, four resurrected World War II-era battleships, 100 nuclear attack submarines, and a reinvigorated Expeditionary Marine Corps. The Navy's budget dramatically expanded, and new keels are being laid in shipyards at rates unseen since World War II. The services were also knitted together into a better functioning whole after the passage of the Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986, which forced senior officers to undergo joint training and unified the command structure of the military branches by centralizing operational command under combatant commanders. Combatant commands are areas of the world, such as European Command in charge of Europe, or Central Command overseeing the Middle East, or specific worldwide areas, such as Transportation Command, which coordinates global military transportation, and Cyber Command, which coordinates offensive and defensive cyber warfare across all of the military branches. All military units report up to combatant commanders, whose region or specialty they belong to, and combatant commanders give orders to all units, regardless of service in their geographic area, instead of having to go in parallel through each service's individual chain of command. It's pretty amazing that this is how we, and pretty much every single other major military, fought every single war up until that point. The Goldwater-Nichols Act is today recognized as one of the most significant and important military reforms ever, although at the time it was, of course, fought bitterly over by some of the old guard trying to keep the privileges and powers that they had previously been able to exert. The new maritime war plan was not to give over the sea to the Soviet Union, but to seize it, to deny Soviet submarines access to the broader Atlantic in the event of war, attack the Soviet Navy in their home ports with our superior carrier forces, and launch amphibious invasions along the huge Soviet coastline, forcing the USSR to divert forces from their armies in Central Europe. But as the 1980s progressed, more and more military attention was diverted from the Soviet Union to the Middle East and North Africa. Reagan sparred with Gaddafi's Libya and embroiled the Marines in the Israeli-Palestine conflict in Lebanon, which resulted in the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, killing 241 servicemen. In the Caribbean, Reagan invaded Grenada after radical Marxists overthrew the government and invited the Cubans and Soviets to build military facilities on the island. All of this was taking place against the backdrop of the Iraq-Iran War, which had been raging since 1980, when Saddam Hussein's Iraq invaded its neighbor, Iran. Iraq and Iran were traditional rivals, but Iran had always had the upper hand prior to the Iranian Revolution, which disintegrated Western support for the country. Iraq took advantage of the revolutionary chaos in Iran and launched an attack in 1980, which quickly devolved into a World War I-style bloodbath, complete with human wave tactics, chemical weapons on the Iraqi side, the mass use of civilian women and children as human shields and one-time use mine clearers on the Iranian side, and the ever-fashionable dash of ethnic cleansing. By 1984, the war was locked in a stalemate. Both sides had lost over 250,000 soldiers. Both Iraq and Iran were trying to stop the other from exporting oil, which of course paid for the whole bloody conflict. As part of its efforts to stop Iraq from exporting oil, Iran installed Silkworm cruise missiles along the Straits of Hormuz, which is a narrow choke point between the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, through which most of the Middle East oil is shipped. Closing the strait would send oil prices through the roof, crash Western economies, and be a huge boon to the Soviet Union, as the prices we paid for their oil exports would also skyrocket and thus feed their military machine. Reagan saw all of this and sent more warships to the straits. Since Iraq lacks a real coastline and exports most of its oil via pipeline through Turkey and Saudi Arabia or through Kuwaiti ships, Iran could not directly respond tit for tat to the Iraqi attacks on Iranian oil facilities. And so Iran turned their attacks on Iraq's Kuwaiti allies. Reagan approved a plan, despite congressional skepticism, of reflagging 11 Kuwaiti tankers as American vessels and affording them the protection of the United States Navy in the Persian Gulf and through the Straits of Hormuz. Reagan, Congress, and the American public very much did not want to get sucked into another regional conflict. This was intended just to be a show of force to dissuade any Iranian meddling with the flow of oil. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff wrote that he, quote, did not believe that the Iranians were going to challenge us seriously. Admiral Crow was wrong. On July 24, 1987, one of the reflagged Kuwaiti ships, the Bridgeton, struck an Iranian mine in the Persian Gulf. At the time, trying to de-escalate the situation, the Reagan administration decided to take a two-pronged approach to countering the mine threat. The overt part of the counter was to rush the Navy's entire small minesweeping fleet to the Gulf. But that alone was not enough, and it was well known that minesweeping was a critical Navy weakness. The covert part of the plan was Operation Prime Chance, which saw Navy SEAL and EOD, which is Explosive Ordnance Disposal Teams, deployed aboard secretly leased oil servicing barges. Utilizing small and fast Army MH-6 helicopters and AH-6 gunships, pilots would skim the water at night wearing night vision goggles, looking for Iranian mine-laying activity. On September 21st, they found what they were looking for. At 2200 hours, USS Jarrett spotted a suspicious vessel on radar and ordered a special team to fly over and take a look. It was the Iran Ajar, a secret Iranian mine-laying ship, which the MH-6 has caught in the act of mine-laying. The AH-6 helicopter gunships moved in and attacked the Iran Ajar with miniguns and rockets, disabling the vessel and forcing most of the crew to jump overboard. A Navy SEAL team then fast-roped onto the vessel, capturing it and 26 Iranians who had not been killed in the helicopter attack for collecting intelligence and sicking the ship. Operation Prime Chance would continue for the next 2 years and occasionally engage Iranian boats caught laying mines, and served as a major deterrent for continued mine-laying operations. Despite the efforts to prevent mines from being laid in the first place, and to clear any mines the Iranians did lay, the Iranian mine-laying effort was not stopped. One of the mines that got through struck the USS Samuel B. Roberts on April 14, 1988, blowing a massive 700-square-foot hole in the ship's port side, breaking her keel, and nearly ripping the ship in half. Her commander, Captain Paul Rinn, who just recently passed away, had trained his ship superbly in damage control, and the ship was saved only through their truly tremendous efforts, fighting fire and flooding for 5 hours. Retaliation was ordered. Most of the American public, and certainly most of the frontline sailors in the Gulf, were hungry to directly attack the Iranians after the mine attack on the Samuel B. Roberts. The Iranians had almost no air defense capability, and destroying their naval bases, mine laying ships, and storage depots, and just about anything else we wanted, would have been very simple. But this had to be countered by the desire to provide enough deterrent to stop the Iranians from repeating the mining, but not enough so that the Iranians felt forced to continue into an escalatory spiral, which they would ultimately lose, but would be painful for us in the meantime, unnecessary, and ultimately run the risk of sparking a broader regional conflict that we didn't want to fight, and especially one that might draw in the Soviet Union. The Reagan administration decided to target two Iranian gas-oil separating platforms, which were serving as command and control centers for Iran's war on the Gulf shipping, and an additional British-built Iranian frigate held over from the Shah's regime, called the Sabalan, whose habit of firing on neutral civilian ships' crew quarters and their lifeboats, and then transmitting to the helpless tanker, "Have a nice day," earned her captain the nickname Captain Nasty. Operation Praying Mantis was launched on the morning of August 18th by three surface action groups, or SAGs, consisting of three surface ships each, and supported by the Carrier Enterprise's Surface Combat Air Patrol planes and Air Force KC-130 refueling tankers. At first light, SAG Bravo approached the first platform. At 0755, the destroyer USS Merrill was within 3 miles of the unsuspecting Iranian platform and sent a warning message in Farsi and English. "You have 5 minutes to abandon the platform. I intend to destroy it at 0800. This transmission stirred the sleeping platform, and the Iranians could be seen running around. Several manned their 23mm gun and trained it on the Merrill, but most made a beeline for the two tugs tied up to the platform. Navy signalmen intercepted a deluge of radio traffic from the platform to Iranian naval headquarters, begging for instructions, while other messages went out to the Merrill asking for more time. At 0804, the Merrill told the remaining Iranians, who all claimed to be martyrs willing to die for the cause, that their time was up and opened fire on the Iranian gun emplacement. The Iranian 23mm gun mount opened up on the Merrill, but was immediately silenced with a direct hit, leaving the platform defenseless against the Merrill's bombardment. The captain of the Merrill was not trying to destroy the platform outright, and ordered airburst rounds to pin down the personnel, destroy the communications gear on the platform, but ultimately leave the platform intact for a helicopter landing. After about 50 rounds had exploded over the southern half of the platform, a large crowd of converted martyrs gathered on the northern end. The Merrill paused firing and allowed a tug to return and pick up what appeared to be the rest of the Iranians on the platform, before resuming airbursts over the entire platform to dislodge any particularly stubborn Iranians left behind. At 0925, SAG Bravo checked fire, and Cobra gunships covered Marines fast roping down onto the platform in a textbook-perfect assault. Within 30 minutes, the Marines had swept the platform and taken down the Iranian flag. 2 hours later, demolition teams used 1,500 pounds of plastic explosives to transform the platform into a fiery inferno. SAG Charlie's assault on the second platform proceeded similarly, except that before the last defender chose to evacuate, a shell set off a secondary explosion from a compressed gas tank, which saved the waiting SEAL team the trouble of boarding by incinerating the platform. While SAG Bravo and Charlie were destroying the Iranian oil and gas separation platforms, SAG Delta was unsuccessfully hunting for the Sabalan, which refused to leave port, where it was nestled tight between two civilian tankers that we were unwilling to destroy as collateral damage. The hope had been that these attacks on the platforms would cause the Iranian Navy to sortie and turn themselves into targets, but a poorly functioning Iranian military command structure, already distracted by an Iraqi ground assault launched 2 hours earlier, was slow to issue orders. It took until 1100 for the Iranians to respond in the form of boghammer armed speedboats attacking Arab tankers and oil platforms in the Persian Gulf. Directed by SAG Delta's USS Jack Williams, the combat air patrol flying overhead sank one boghammer and sent the rest racing back for shore. At 1130, the Iranian fast attack craft Joshan, carrying the only functional Harpoon anti-ship missile in the Iranian fleet, closed in on SAG Charlie. The Joshan was repeatedly warned that she should change course but ignored the warnings. Because it was not a war, but a limited strike designed to punish the Iranians without forcing them into an escalatory spiral, Admiral Less, who commanded Operation Praying Mantis, only had permission to sink one Iranian warship, and he did not want to waste the sinking on the small Joshan. Finally, after four ignored warnings, and with a Joshan coming within 13 miles of SAG Charlie, Admiral Less gave the SAG commander weapons free, or permission to fire at will. One last warning of, "Stop your engines and abandon ship, I intend to sink you," was issued. The Joshan fired its harpoon. The three SAG Charlie ships immediately detected the launch, maneuvered and launched chaff to hopefully confuse the incoming missile. The harpoon passed down the USS Wainwright's starboard side close aboard, and was answered by a volley of four SM-1 missiles from the Simpson and Wainwright aimed at the Joshan. All four of the American missiles hit, disabling the vessel. An additional SM-1, a hit, and a harpoon, a miss, were fired, and the patrol boat was eventually finished off with gunfire. In an apparently poorly timed surface air, coordinated, assault, an Iranian F-4 Phantom closed in on SAG Charlie, ignoring warnings to turn around before the SAG fired two missiles and hit the Iranian aircraft, which somehow managed to limp back to Iranian airspace. Having defeated the first two Iranian retaliation attempts, intelligence indicated that the Iranians were determined to inflict some damage in response to the destruction of their oil and gas separation platforms. At 1459, an Iranian frigate sortied from port and towards SAG Delta. It was not Captain Nasty Sabalon, but a sister ship of the same class, the Sahand. After firing on an A-6E intruder aircraft, which swooped low to confirm the target, the two intruders circling overhead unleashed two harpoon missiles, four rockets, and several laser-guided bombs on the Sahand, coordinated with a harpoon from the USS Joseph Strauss to achieve near-simultaneous times on target in the first-ever coordinated naval missile attack in combat. The Sahand was left burning, and by nightfall, was the first Blue Water combatant sunk by enemy fire since World War II. In the meantime, Captain Nasty Sabalon had finally emerged from port. Now, Admiral Less had already stretched the letter of his instructions by destroying two platforms, an Iranian frigate, and several smaller craft to boot. But if the Iranians were stupid enough to start a fight, Admiral Less was going to finish it. Again, an A-6E intruder flew close to the Iranian frigate to get a visual identification, and again, the Iranians made it very clear that they were an enemy vessel, but opening fire on the American plane. Which, of course, was all the permission that the plane needed to drop a 500-pound laser-guided bomb on the Sabalon, which knocked out her engines and broke her keel. SAG Charlie moved in for the kill and requested permission to attack the now defenseless and burning vessel. The request went up and up and up the chain of command until it reached the desk of the Secretary of Defense and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is pretty far from the days where halfway around the world meant sending and receiving a message took a year and captains could do as they pleased at sea. Eventually, the secretary and the chairman decided that the destruction meted out thus far was enough, and the Iranians were allowed to send tugs to tow the Sabalon back to port. Operation Praying Mantis was a complete success. The planning was well done, the Army, Marine Corps, Air Force, and Navy units all worked smoothly together, and half of Iran's operational navy was blown up. It was the biggest sea battle the world has seen since the end of World War II. The next year, a ceasefire forced by Iraqi gains on the ground put an end to the broader conflict in the Persian Gulf, but the U.S. Navy's role had been vital. By protecting the Gulf, Kuwait, and the flow of oil from other Arab states, the United States protected the world's economy and gave the reassurance other Arab states needed to support Iraq in the Iraq-Iran War, which may have been the difference. No other Western Navy possessed the ability to launch this much force for such a sustained amount of time so far from home. Shortly after the end of the Iraq-Iran War, President George H.W. Bush replaced Reagan as president, and the world was on the cusp of geopolitical realignment. The Soviet Union's Afghan invasion had proved disastrous, and a reignited Reagan-era arms race brought more strain than the Soviet economy could bear, and the constituent parts of the USSR's Warsaw Pact and constituent Soviet republics began to break away from the Russian core. Just as Secretary of the Navy Lehman and Reagan's wave of shipbuilding was cresting, the need for a 600-ship fleet mandated by the maritime strategy was crumbling. This brought more debate, with plenty of navalists, including former Marine officer and Assistant Secretary of Defense Jim Webb, who argued that the fleet needed to be kept strong, in part because of the Navy's unparalleled international reach. With a superpower crumbling, the shifts in power and politics became unpredictable, and he viewed the Navy as a cheap deterrent and insurance. In conflicts short of war, and when there was a need to provide immediate deterrence to rogue nations, the Navy is almost always the military service which can best answer the president's call. Assistant Secretary of Defense Jim Webb, in a 1984 memo, clearly describes the Navy's use as an indispensable diplomatic tool. Quote, "The mobility and potential firepower of a naval task force are perhaps the most demonstrable way to give credibility to hostile negotiations. However, this is only true if the naval presence transcends that of a, quote, maritime presence, or the capability to project, and becomes a true sea presence, the capability to control. One backed up with a workable supply chain, plus combatant ships that are replaceable, and thus can be put at risk. The 600-ship Navy is in reality a rather modest comeback from a period of very serious neglect. When I commissioned in 1968, the Navy had 930 ships and no Indian Ocean commitment," end quote. By the end of 1991, the USSR was gone, and with it, the rationale for a Navy capable of countering the Soviet fleet. Assistant Secretary Webb's arguments were not persuasive to Congress, and in 1987, Webb was appointed as Secretary of the Navy, but resigned a year later in the face of what he considered unacceptable budget cuts at the end of the Reagan administration. To Congress, the Cold War was over and the West had won. The building program was trimmed down and older ships were again decommissioned, although the Navy retained its global reach and was more relatively powerful than ever, with the Soviet threat gone and the UK's Royal Navy a ghost of its former glory. President Bush had the Navy spearhead an intervention in the Philippines to support the democratic government against the coup attempt, and another in Panama to capture the dictator Manuel Noriega, and in Libya to rescue Americans from the raging civil war. In 1990, Saddam Hussein made the dumb decision to invade its neighbor and former ally Kuwait in a blatant oil grab. After refusing the United Nations resolution to withdraw, the U.S.-led coalition crushed the Iraqi army in Operation Desert Storm, which saw the deployment of 6 aircraft carriers and the largest concentrated application of naval air power ever. Saudi Arabia is now firmly our major partner in the Middle East and staunchly opposed to Iran, largely on ideological grounds. The Saudi royal family has no interest in seeing an Iranian-style revolution exported to their shores and is dead set against seeing Iran become the regional hegemon. On Iran's side, their government continues to be dominated by religious hardliners, and despite their protestations of innocence, it is absolutely building towards a nuclear bomb and jockeying with Turkey, Israel, and Saudi Arabia to be the regional big man as we try to reduce our commitment in the region and free up resources to focus on China. This ends the Cold War. I still have one more dedicated submarine episode coming up to wrap up the second season. After that, I'm going to do a 1990 until today episode, which I'll go into a lot more detail on the first and second Gulf Wars, as well as the rest of the naval operations in the past 30-odd years, before branching into some issues facing the Navy today. Beyond that, I'm not 100% sure where to take this podcast, and I'd like your ideas. I have a ton of possible ideas written down, and a few of you have been kind enough to send me some suggestions, but I wanted to ask the broader audience as well, so what do you think? Should I do a deep dive on individual battles or famous captains and admirals? Talk about some interesting aspects of shipboard life? Let me know what you think. I would love your suggestions, as well as your ratings on whatever platform you listen to. Unless, of course, you think I deserve less than 5 stars, in which case, please forget I ever mentioned ratings. But in all seriousness, thank you for listening to my episodes thus far. Subscribe so that you get the next episode as soon as it comes out, and tell your friends. Post about the show on social media, whatever you feel comfortable doing, because I really do have a passion for naval history and I want to spread the word. Thanks for listening.